Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte's most lucrative annual event shops around and chooses Baltimore. What the loss of the CIAA tournament means. Fact, if you run from something, you're also running toward something, and that's why we have two points of view. On Mark Harris's exit from the government building on Monday, we'll fill you in. It turns out the city under-budgeted the Cross Charlotte Trail by $77 million. Project started 6 years ago, and we just discovered this little oversight. And scooters may find themselves regulated in short order. Our roundtable of reporters is here to talk about those and other stories, and they include Steve Harrison here from WFAE News. Good morning and welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Dawes Helms has been away for a while. She joins us from the Charlotte Observer, where she's the education reporter there.
Good morning. Good morning.
And it is the Battle of the TV Titans. In one corner, Nick Oxner joins us from WBTV News.
Hello, hello.
Good for you. You're always on our side. And in the other, Joe Bruno returns from WSOC-TV's Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Good morning and welcome to you, too.
Great to be here.
We're all on
he said more words in his intro than he said in mine.
Okay. They pay better. We're all on the radio, but if that is enough, you can join us on Facebook Live this morning. Okay, it's official. The Central Intercollegiate Athletic Association, the CIAA, will cut the nets in Charlotte after their 2020 tournament here and head to Baltimore. This is the most lucrative event that Charlotte holds every year, to the tune of $50.5 million, sending that into the local economy. The Observer called this a massive loss. How big a deal is this, Steve?
So I think it is the single biggest annual event that comes to Charlotte. But I think it's important to kind of, a little perspective, like for hotels in this city, this is not a big convention town. Hotels sell about 75% of their rooms through like leisure and business travel. And that's where they make their money. And the CIAA accounts for about a little under 0.5% of all the rooms sold in a year.
Yeah.
So it's the biggest event, but it's still a tiny piece of the pie. And when you take it away, I do think that other business will come back. You can get another tournament. You can get another event. Business travelers will come back. So it's a big deal. But then when you look at it, you kind of step back. It's not the end of the world.
Well, that $50.5 million, as I understand it, is the money that restaurateurs and hoteliers and other people who cater to tourists will get. How much does the city get as a result of the hotel motel tax and the other associated fees that come with tourists from that event?
Right. So I haven't broken down the number, but the city spends about, I think they'll give the CIAA about $1.6 million. I think that's about right for this upcoming tournament. So, you know, they have to spend about $1.6 there will be costs for more police work, et cetera. So I think if you kind of look at it as a strictly a tax dollar out, in a tax dollar end basis, it's probably about a wash.
So we can't use that money for the Greenway, which we'll talk about later.
That's right.
They will have been in Charlotte, I think, for 15 years at when they play their final game here in 2020. And attendance has been falling in recent years. I think last year they roped off 7,000 seats in the arena because they didn't sell them. And the chair of the CIAA, James Anderson, said that price gouging has become an issue in the last several years. Which was the bigger issue, the price gouging, which we can talk about, or the fact that maybe people who come here after 15 years are just tired of it? They want to go someplace else, do something else. We don't change much here. It's not like Disney World changing the attractions every year.
Councilman Mitchell seemed, he was livid, first of all, that he was really disappointed that Charlotte did not win this selection. He called it a bad bid. That's pretty strong
he called
word.
It worse than that.
He did.
Well, for the CRVA executives to be fired, practically.
Pretty much. He said heads needed to roll. But one of the problems that he had was that the hotel prices could not come down for Charlotte's bid here. He also hit on the Spectrum Center for only offering two nights for the tournament instead of three. And he also, in the past, he has called for more money for scholarships. He said that Baltimore was trying to give $2 million in scholarships. It ended up evening out with Charlotte and Baltimore offering $1.5 million, but corporate support was something that Councilman Mitchell was really hoping for.
But if you listen to Councilman Mitchell's general gripes. It's that the city wasn't willing to put up more tax dollars, which is kind of a shock when you hear how he's approached some other sports development and the comments he made about the soccer stadium. He's taken more of a realistic approach. But his primary beef here seems to be that the city wasn't willing to put more money into this event, and I don't know that in this case it was prudent.
Well, since you brought up James Mitchell, and we're going to go out of order here, and we'll hear from James Mitchell because he talked about this at the meeting on Monday, and to quote him now, I underline this in strong letters, to quote him, our bid was piss poor.
I don't think we sent the message that this terminal is very important to us. We appreciate during the whole HB2 discussion, everybody left us except for UCIAA. And so I think the bid was very disrespectful for a terminal that put us on the map. Before the DNC, for the RNC, there was a CIAA.
So Councilman Justin Harlow wants the CRVA to conduct a study on why we lost the tournament. But yesterday on this program, Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eiselt was here, and she was fairly low-key about this loss and kind of said, well, you know, after 15 years, they probably want to go to Baltimore Harbor and have some crabs, essentially is what she said. I mean,
I think one other thing that's interesting about it, and this is not just the CIAA, but when the CRVA tries to get conventions here, they often say one of their biggest problems is to get the hotel rooms to lower their rates to be competitive because the hotels are already so full and they're making so much money on business travel, leisure travel. Mm. So it's like, well, then what's the problem, right? If the hotel is full and making money, why then should they lower their rates to sell rooms they could sell for more money to someone else?
That is not the case in Baltimore?
I think that, I mean, I saw one report that that someone from the CIAA said Baltimore had more like city-owned or city-invested hotels. Maybe they could lower their prices. But, I mean, I think it may be a case of, you know, the Uptown hotel market here was really small for a long time. Yeah. And, you know, I think maybe that, right, we are just, this is a big business town.
I think Charlotte is still at a lack of hotel rooms, even though they've almost doubled the amount of Uptown hotels in the last 2 to 3 years. But, again, it just goes back to the question that I'll continue to raise is how much sense does it make to dump millions of dollars into hosting a thing that your business community may not necessarily need?
Hmm. Which is the prevailing point of view on council? You have Julie Eiselt here yesterday kind of, she's okay. It's time for change. And then you have James Mitchell and Justin Harlow who are upset about this. Which is the prevailing point of view?
I think that it will end up being kind of Julie's point of view that this happens and things move on. And, you know, and there will be another bid, right? The Baltimore, how long is the Baltimore?
Till 2023.
Yeah.
So they'll try again.
And, of course, we stole those games from what? Raleigh, I think?
That's right.
They came from Raleigh 15 years ago. Board Chair James Anderson said that Baltimore has a vision of how their tournament can be woven into the fabric of that city. And that's not all. Here's what he told Baltimore.
We got the feeling that you wanted us in your future. And that was really, really important. Not every city gave us that sense.
Is that a reference to us? Because they've been saying that maybe we don't like them very much.
I think, too, one thing that's happened in the 2018 tournament kind of went off without a hitch. Mm-hmm. But remember, you know, 2 or 3 years before that, there was some violence, like, associated with the tournament or, you know, tournament, like, not sponsored events, but kind of like these secondary parties. And there was media coverage about that. I wrote about it. We all, you know, every station did. And I think that, I know the CIAA was very sensitive to that. They felt like it was not fair that they were being blamed for this. And I think there's probably some hard feelings on that, too.
And there was that unfortunate incident a couple of years ago where a group of people who were here for the tournament got a ticket that literally said CIAA surcharge and added money to their tab as opposed to, you know, an automatic gratuity for a large party or whatever. So that really, I think, cast doubt in people's minds.
We spend a lot of time talking about things like this, wringing our hands over losses of this and the lack of Amazon choosing us, et cetera. I'm not sure that the average Charlottean listening has given this a nanosecond's thought, because this all happens downtown. And unless you live downtown or work downtown and happen to be here while the traffic's coming in for the CIAA, it's not a big deal. And Julie Eisel pointed out yesterday that we have some time to plan for this loss. The games are here through 2020. And in 2020, we're hosting the Republican convention, which will bring in at least double the revenue that the CIAA is bringing in. And we'll be hosting the NBA All-Star game as well. So this is really what? A speed hump?
I think that's... Hey, if you are looking at the grander picture of the CRVA and the tourism business in Charlotte, I think they'll be able to backfill. I think the hotels will be fine. I think there'll be other people to go to these restaurants. And while it's always disappointing to lose a thing, right, I don't think it's the end of the world.
And I think it's kind of unfortunate that we have a rare all-white panel here today, because this may feel different in the African-American community than it does to the white folks.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think it's fair to call the CIAA loss a speed hump, because this just has such a huge impact, especially for all the HBCUs that are near Charlotte. There are some HBCUs up north in the CIAA that this tournament will benefit, but I do think it is a huge loss for the city of Charlotte.
And they pointed to that as one of the reasons they want to move, that the northern teams have to travel pretty far away to come here, as do their fans, and maybe it's time to give them a shorter distance to travel for a couple of years, and that's a good thing. Okay, the loss of the CIAA tournament wasn't the only thing that set off alarms in Charlotte this week.
Wow, they just set off the fire alarm.
That is the sound of an alarm going off when Mark Harris opened a security door to quickly exit the government center on Monday as he was being pursued by reporters.
Hey, Mr. Harris, we just had a couple questions.
That's WBTV's David Hodges, but I'm told that you, Joe Bruno, were the first reporter to be alerted to Mark Harris's presence in the building or his impending exit. I'm not sure which. He was at a GOP meeting next door to the council chamber. Why was he there?
He was there to talk to local Republicans. Eventually,
more planning, apparently, is why he was there.
Okay. He was next door to the Charlotte City Council meeting. You have a room full of reporters right next to where Mark Harris is speaking. Eventually, the word's going to trickle in that room that he's there. So eventually, all the reporters and photographers, they stood outside the Mecklenburg County Republican meeting waiting for him to come on out so we could just ask a couple questions. And I feel bad because Steve and I were talking the whole time, and I'm like, there's only one exit out of this building. He's going to have to come this way by us. And then he used the emergency exit, something I was not planning
for. Which, now, was he told he could use the emergency? I've read conflicting reports about this, that security in the building said, just go down this stairway. And when he did and opened the outside door, the fire alarm went off.
Yeah, that's what he told me. He said, he left through the fire alarm, and he said that he gets in his car, drives away, and immediately thinks, like, oh, that wasn't good.
And if he checked Twitter, he quickly realized that there are a lot of ways to make fun of someone running away on Twitter.
No politician looks good running away from reporters.
So that was Monday night, and then Tuesday he does a lot of interviews and kind of apologizes for that.
As sloppy as part one was, I'd say part two was actually surprisingly, you know, the contrition was surprising from a politician, and the fact that he talked to so many people and just kind of owned up to it. How often do we hear that?
Well, to catch people up in case they don't know who Mark Harris is. I find that almost impossible to believe, but it may be true that he's...
There cannot be one NPR listener.
Right. He was the first... Initially, he was the winner in the 9th Congressional District until allegations of voter tampering cropped up and they refused to certify the race, and now it's in limbo at the moment over everything. He sent this tweet saying he was running toward a television set to see the Clemson... Alabama game, and we of course have portrayed him as running away from reporters. What is true? And we only have about 20 seconds, but what is the truth here, do you think?
Not the football game.
Oh, come on. Everybody watched that.
We were clearly there. It would be impossible for him to not notice our presence.
And he did say, and he did tell me, he said, I saw them. I didn't want to talk. I wanted to get out of there. So
we'll talk a little more about this when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Joe Bruno is here from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News, is here as well, along with Ann Dawes-Helms from the Charlotte Observer and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. We were talking about Mark Harris and his exit, sudden exit, quick exit from the government center on Monday night, being pursued by reporters. He later said that was a mistake looking back on it. And so Tuesday, he came out and talked to everybody in the media. Steve, he talked to you about the man at the center of the controversy over his election, McCrae Dowless. He was hired by the Harris campaign to help get out the vote, and allegedly he may have engaged in some not-so-legal tactics. Former Congressman Robert Pittenger has called McCrae Dowless a political prostitute because he has been known to work for politicians on both sides, and Pittenger says he also believed Dowless was shady. But Mark Harris told you, Steve, that he had no reason to suspect Dowless.
I mean, when I was, as you said, sold on this program that he was going to do, which again had been verified, was legal and was following the letter of the law, and it was relationships, nobody else was focusing on that. So why would I expect that success was a bad thing?
So Harris allegedly is the one who directly said, "I'm going to hire a McCrae Dowless."
Allegedly, he's admitted to that.
Would it be beyond the realm of possibility that a political rookie, as Harris has called himself, would know to be suspicious of McCrae Dowless?
I think,
as Robert Pittenger was.
So when I sat down with him, we talked a lot about kind of the past results that McCrae Dowless had produced in terms of numbers and absentee ballots that were really crazy in terms of how many votes he would get for his candidate. And I kind of asked Mark Harris over and over again, like, I mean, how did you think this was possible? Was this too good to be true? And he, you know, really said, well, this is what he did. He kind of kept referring to McCrae Dowless as his, like, program. You know, it was kind of an odd term of, like, once you sign up for the program, great things are going to happen. And he kind of put no distance between himself and McCrae Dowless. He really owned it and said, we talked all the time. I thought he was a great guy.
But, which he has from the beginning. When I first talked to him in mid-December, this was right after the Washington Post article came out, but before Harris had confirmed that he hired Dowless, but the Washington Post suggested it. I sat down with him, I think, the next day and asked him, did you hire McCrae Dowless? He said, yes. I mean, just came out and said it, and I was prepared to have to push him a little bit. But that being said, In my first conversation with him in December, he gave the most plausible explanation one could. Look, he went to Bladen County. He sat around with a group of pretty influential Republicans, he said, in the county, who all said, boy, you really should hire McCrae, including, he said, a guy named Marion Warren, who's a judge from that part of the world and is the director of the administrative offices of the courts. Other local politicians, Pat Melvin, who's a businessman in Bladen County. And so that is not an implausible explanation in my view, that if you go to a county and the local county politico say, hire this guy,
yeah,
I would hire this guy.
So, Joe, you also spoke with Mark Harris this week, and you asked about what he knew and when he knew it and about his expectations going forward. What did he tell you?
I actually did not.
Oh, you did
speak
not
with Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris spoke to Paul Boyd, one of the reporters for Channel 9.
Excuse me.
Oh, no problem.
Why isn't he here then? Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, we got the same impression as Steve did, really, that they are, you know, Mr. Harris is sticking with McCrae here. He's not separating himself from him. Of course, that doesn't mean that, let me just say this. Everything that we have reported, there's a lot of evidence that McCrae Dowless was possibly doing something sketchy in Blaine County with this whole election. We have nothing that shows that Mark Harris was involved.
Okay. And he is still defending McCrae Dowless, if I'm reading the tea leaves, right? If that's the case, Steve, is that wise, given the allegations that have been circling around McCrae Dowless for weeks now?
I asked him, I said, well, if you had another campaign and McCrae was done with his potential legal problems, everything was over, would you hire him again? And he said, well, I can't really say. I won't speak of hypotheticals. So,
does he believe that these charges, these allegations against McCrae Dowless, might be without foundation?
He didn't say that. He just kind of said, you know, we're going to wait for the investigation to finish, and I hope they're, you know, he said, I hope they're not true, but There was no, you know.
Well, here's another point that we need to talk. Put this in greater context. This is not just a McRae-Dallas thing in right. Bladen County. This is a thing that people and Republicans and Democrats, McRae has done this as a Republican and a Democrat in Bladen right. County, as right. you alluded to. But McRae-Dallas wasn't the only person doing this in Bladen County in 2018. He's not been the only person doing this. If you read the investigative report released by the Board of Elections into their 16 findings, it includes Dallas, yes. It also includes a group called the Bladen County Improvement Association PAC, which is a Democrat-aligned group funded by the Democratic Party in large part. And this has been going on. As someone who's from Cumberland County, not in Hope Mills, not terribly far from this neck of the woods, this is a thing that has been going on for decades that many people have been doing.
So what you're saying is, in many ways, Mark Harris is caught in the middle of this.
He could be. He could be. And I think if you continue to look, and our reporting has shown, you know, we've talked to people whose ballots were collected this cycle by the Bladen Improvement Association.
Right.
Of course, there are lots of people who say their ballots were collected by McRae-Dallas. So, you know, it would be wrong to say that the Harris campaign may have been the only people who benefited from this.
Okay, Joe.
Next major step in all this is Monday. The briefs are due related to the Harris lawsuit that were filed. So we'll see if the McCready campaign or if the State Board of Elections files anything related to Mark Harris suing to be certified as the winner.
For a while, and this has been going back and forth among Republicans who immediately said seat him, and then Democrats in Congress saying, no, we're not going to seat him until he's certified, and then Republicans saying we must have a new election and we got to go back to the primary to do it, to the point where I think Mark Harris at one point was saying, hey, even if you count all these suspicious ballots, I still win. I still have enough votes against my competitor that I should still win, and I will win, and I should be seated. Is he still saying that?
Yeah,
largely. Absolutely.
And yeah. Congress is still saying, we don't know about that.
And I mean, and he is right. If you take away every absentee mail vote he got in Bladen County and Robeson County, he still wins by, what, 150 votes? Is that right? Something it's small. And so the big question will be, can anyone find evidence of like large scale people throwing votes away? I mean, I think that will end that argument.
And the State Board of Elections, the law says that you don't need more fraud, though, than the margin of victory. There is that provision that says they can declare a new election if they think the whole thing is tainted. That would certainly be a big step, though, and it's something they wouldn't take lightly, just to say that.
Okay. So I think it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before yesterday, actually it was Monday, I guess, when the council discovered this, that for 6 years we've been building this thing called the Cross Charlotte Trail, where the city has been putting money into connecting the various greenways, with the goal at the end of the project being that all these greenways are connected and we have a system of bike and walking trails that connect the entire city that can be used for recreational purposes, and it can also be used for commuter purposes. If you want to get on your bike and ride from your neighborhood to downtown to work, you can do that when this is all done. $38 million is what they budgeted for this, and on Monday they discovered they are $77 million short. That means they misbudgeted this thing by two-thirds. Why are we just hearing about this now?
It's a massive failure. I mean, council members were astonished when they learned this on Monday night. I mean,
who broke the good news to them?
The staffers, city staffers. All right. You know, voters were sold a Cadillac and they ended up with a Toyota Camry.
That's a good car.
And I think one thing too about it is like you talk about the Cadillac. Like people were really excited about the Cadillac. Like when I would talk to people out in the community. You know, it's a project like people are really into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would hear people ask me questions about it. They were looking forward to it. They thought it was a great thing. So it's like there's a lot of things the city does that are important, but like, you know, it's not that big of a deal. People really were jazzed about this.
We're already like dead last in parks and greenways as it is. So here we are being sold a 26-mile greenway connecting Pineville to Cabarrus County, and now we're being told that only half of it can be finished.
And they're saying the option could be, well, how about if we just put up signs along these sidewalks and say it's part of the greenway?
Right.
I don't think people are going to be excited about that.
When did they know this? I mean, they told council Monday, but when did they know it? Have they been just kind of going, how are we going to break the news?
Someone in the meeting was like, I think I remember you mentioning something once during the retreat, but I don't know. I was at that retreat. I don't remember hearing anything about this. But also, if they just put signs saying this is the Charlotte Trail now on sidewalks and streets, does that like harm their Vision Zero approach?
Oh, you know,
because they're having runners go through traffic?
For years, I guess they're still up. There are signs down Woodlawn Road with, I think, a bicycle on them. It says Route 4, which I think is a bicycle route, and it's been a bicycle route since 1980, something like that. And that route, if you look for the signs, they're there, and you can follow that. But I've never seen anybody ride a bike on Woodlawn Road, particularly between South Boulevard and Park Road. You're taking your life into your hands. So yesterday on this program, Julie Eiselt expressed alarm that this could have happened because of a lack of planning on a long-term project, because I mean, this has been on the drawing boards for a very long time. How do you miss budget for something like this? And at Monday's council meeting, council member Braxton Winston said he was bugging out over this turn of events. Republican Ed Driggs said, I'm kind of flabbergasted by these numbers. And one emailer to this program yesterday wondered if there could be other city projects in similar trouble that we don't know about yet. Is this the exception to normally good planning, or is this the rule? Because we were without a city planner for years. For years.
It certainly hurts their credibility. I think, you know, next time you come for a bond, people are going to be saying, you know, are we really going to get what you're promising, or is this just the down payment and you're going to come back and say it costs two or three times as much?
Because when the new city manager came in, and Julie brought this up yesterday, Marcus Jones is the new city manager. He had nothing to do with this because he wasn't here back when this was put on the drawing boards and even brought to a vote in the bond issue. One of the first things he did was to institute 10-year planning because the city didn't have any 10-year plans. And Julie was expressing astonishment at that. How can you run a city without long-term plans. And some people are wondering if we were sold a bill of goods on this, that we knew that this would happen. Because how could you not know if you put a green... The problems are in the northern part of this, right? Where the Lynx Blue Line goes up toward University. How could you not know that those land values were going to increase precipitously when that construction began and was completed, and why didn't you plan for that when you said this is what it's going to cost?
And that's what they're saying, is that what they did was take the price of land, of Greenway land, in the most remote areas and then just sort of extrapolate that we'll get that same price everywhere, which, again, even I know that doesn't work. But you would think a city planner would know.
But the skeptics among us, I won't name any names, but are saying that, well, maybe they knew that it was going to cost more than $38 million, but if we went ahead and started it, we'd have to find the rest of the money.
That's what, to me, is so interesting. Like, I mean, I think in government there's always situations where things cost more than they thought and it takes longer. But they get finished and they get kind of beat up in the press about it, but it gets done. This was so strange because it was just like, well, it's over. We won't finish. And I just, you rarely hear that where they throw in the towel.
So you were, I'm sorry, Joe, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to bring up that, you know, now there are proposals to use possibly the hotel motel tax to finish this
project.
That's
where I was going.
Yes. And, you know, that would be an interesting proposal because, of course, it's required for tourism purposes. And I believe it was Steve who was reporting that Councilman Winston was like, you know, in New York, they advertise greenways and parks as tourism attractions.
And the High Line, which is a trail, is a tourist attraction in New York City.
But I wonder if they use the hotel motel tax or give it any serious thought, if that will set up another greenway versus sports argument that we saw with the county when they were discussing the MLS.
Well, you did a whole story on this morning, Steve.
That's right.
Talk about it.
So, like Joe said, hotel motel taxes are kind of, by state law, have to be used for tourism. And traditionally, the city uses it for big kind of ticket items like the stadium or the arena, NASCAR Hall of Fame. And so Braxton Winston said, you know, this is an attraction. Why don't we use some of this money to finish this greenway? And it's a pretty good idea. He didn't really get a lot of support at the time. I think that a lot of council members are worried that they've got to protect all this money for the Panthers. Panthers, Panthers, Panthers. They can't jeopardize anything to do with the stadium. But like Joe said, this is a classic argument of this is a project that so many people want and are excited about.
When was this project supposed to be finished?
I don't know. I know they started. I mean, they first started talking about in 2013, I remember, when they were floating the capital improvement program.
And they have a contract that the city staff wanted them to approve coming up, too, for like the first leg with the actual $38 million that we have. So,
because as you reported this morning, Steve, Mecklenburg County generates $91 million a year from this tourism tax. Does it all go to the county, or does the city get part of that money?
Well, so no, it's it all goes to the city. It's a countywide tax, and okay. The city council controls it.
So we're short $77 million. So that's certainly in that 91 if they wanted to take it all, but they're not going to take it all. They couldn't take it all because they take it incrementally over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years and finish this project that way without hurting some of the other money or other projects that this money is earmarked for.
So, yeah, they could. I mean, some of that $91 million a year, some of it has to go to the Hall of Fame. Some of it has, but then there is a piece of that that goes to, like, general tourism or amateur sports venues. Like, could you even sell the Greenway or the trail as an amateur sports thing?
Why not?
You run races on it. They have $70 million set aside for the Panther Stadium in 2023. So it's like $70 million for the Panthers. It's going to come up in 4 years. The Greenway costs $77 million.
Yeah.
Look, you think people are angry because the Greenway can't be finished. Imagine if we lost the Panthers.
That's right.
And that's what you're thinking if you're a member of the Charlotte City Council, right?
And you're also up against the fact that David Tepper is in serious talks to move the practice facility and the team headquarters to Fort Mill, South Carolina. It would just be another chink in the armor to go ahead and move the stadium down there. If he wants a new stadium, he could put it in South Carolina. We are the Carolinas team, he says, right? Would it make that much of a difference to him whether we were in Charlotte, except for the beauty shots?
Yeah, that. But I think it'd be a big stretch if the stadium moved. But that being said,
they did it in Dallas.
Yeah. That being said, yeah. Would you want to be the city council member who just took that for granted and ended up losing it?
So what are their options? Do they even know? The city?
I don't think they know. No, I think they're one of the council members. Like, I don't even know what to do with this information. I think they're all trying to figure out where they go from here.
Is there a place they can point to for blame? Is somebody going to take the fall for this, or is this just going to be something, well, somebody goofed up and let's figure out a way out of this?
I don't think the finger pointing has started yet with this.
Okay.
I think they're still comprehending how they got into this situation.
Okay. Well, we have scooters to talk about because for a long time the city council was not going to get involved in regulating scooters because they were expecting the legislature to regulate them, and they haven't done it. But all this, that was just before Christmas. Now they're coming back on Monday, and they're going to talk about regulating scooters because more scooters hit the roads or the sidewalks in December. And we're going to talk about that when we come back. We're also going to talk about the new legislature being sworn in. And if Mark Harris can't be seated in Congress because of issues over absentee ballots, how did Rachel Hunt make it into the legislature? We'll talk about that as well. And there's some school issues to talk about. That's why Ann is here, and we'll do all that, too, in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Your idea could be the next great podcast. WFAE has launched the Queen City Podquest, a contest to find a new story for the next big show. All ideas are welcome. Submit yours by January 27th at wfae.org/Queen City Podquest.
It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner's here from WBTV News. Steve Harrison from WFAE News. And Joe Bruno from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. They're taking up the idea of regulating scooters at next Monday's City Council meeting. Mayor Pro Tem Julie Ossoff was on this program yesterday, and here's what she told us.
The legislature kind of indicated that they're not, they've decided not to regulate vehicles. And vehicles are defined as the scooters, the e-bikes. So other cities have already done it. We feel that it's imperative that we put some rules in place.
So this is a 180 from what they were saying just last month about this. Do we know what's driving this or who on council may be driving this move toward regulating scooters?
No, but I will say for scooter enthusiasts like myself, they fared pretty well with these proposed rules because there isn't anything too, nothing too bad that I think the scooter companies will get upset and pull their scooters from the streets.
Okay.
They're proposing to keep scooters off of sidewalks on certain streets in Uptown, which is not a big deal. Scooters can't be on roads that with a speed limit more than 35 miles per hour. I think everybody agrees they shouldn't be on I-277 or, you know, Independence Boulevard. And then the other thing is they want scooters spread out throughout the city. They want them to be placed in low-income neighborhoods. They don't want them all congregated in Uptown and South End. And as we've seen in like Raleigh and some other cities, they're starting to charge these massive per scooter fees to the company, and the company is then turning that fee back on the people who use the scooters.
Yeah, Raleigh charges $300 a scooter, and we don't charge anything. And is that really massive? I mean, when you consider that it's per scooter.
Well, that's new.
What do they charge for a scooter? Right, a dollar?
It's a dollar to start, and then it's per mile. But then these companies in Raleigh are adding like a $2 or $3 surcharge for people who go.
$2 surcharge.
Yes.
Yeah, because of that. So I think in the ongoing war between Charlotte and Raleigh, Raleigh has a far less growth friendly policy just over on the whole. And this is another example where Charlotte can differentiate itself by welcoming things.
So at the same time, they want to take these scooters off the sidewalks in certain places. They also want to lower the top speed a scooter can achieve. What is it now, 15 miles an hour or something like that?
Right. They want to set that limit at 15. And I don't think any of the scooters right now go they don't go faster than that.
But Larkin Eggleston, who's on city council, is worried that if you take the scooters off the sidewalk, put them in the street with cars, and lower their ability to travel fast, you're putting them at a disadvantage when it comes to automobile traffic being juxtaposed next to them. Is that a genuine concern, you think?
I think that's a genuine concern. I also think it comes down to the riders, though, being aware of where they are scooting around in the city. They have to be just as smart. You know, they can't be in the middle of the street if their scooter's only going 10 miles per hour.
Are people using these as a means of transportation to get to work, or just short hops while they're at work to go to lunch or to go pick up a file at another building that's part of your organization? How are they being used? Because they want to put 20% of these scooters every morning in low-income areas. That to me tells me they want you to use them as a transportation option.
What's really interesting to me is during the city council meeting, they asked the council members, guess where like this area is where all the scooters are going. And one of the most popular spots that the scooters are being taken to is the Walmart on Wilkinson Boulevard.
Wow.
They think that the scooter can really be the answer to the first and last mile for public transportation. You have so many times you're taking the light rail to go somewhere or a bus to go somewhere, but that's not your final destination. Right. They view the scooter as the means for somebody to be able to get to their final destination after getting off public transportation.
I think one thing that's interesting is this requirement. They're going to make the companies put 20% in low-income neighborhoods. There's obviously been a lot of talk at the city about economic mobility and economic opportunity. I can't think of a other instance where they've had rules like that on a private business that says you must open up in this geographical area and place your product here. I'll be curious if that goes well. Like, will we ever see talk about the grocery store argument?
Is that constitutional?
You know, I don't think the scooter companies have a problem with it, so there may not be any kind of legal question. But I do think if you keep going down the road, I think it'll be an interesting question. Like, what happens next?
A new state legislature was sworn in this week. 50 of the 120 members of the House are new. 34 women will serve in the House. 10 will be serving in the Senate. And, of course, Mecklenburg County's delegation consists of 16 Democrats and one Republican. Wow. How has the makeup of the legislature, Nick, overall shifted as a result of this last election, and how will that change things?
Yes, the biggest change is that both houses, the House and the Senate, both chambers lost their supermajority, Republican supermajorities, which means that Republicans no longer have a veto-proof majority. And so functionally what that means, if they want to pass bills that become law, they're going to have to get at least some buy-in from some Democrats. And so you already heard, we'll see if this actually plays out, but you've already heard in his opening speech this week, Senate Republican leader Phil Berger talked about needing bipartisanship, where this time last year, the word bipartisanship was not anywhere in Phil Berger's
mind.
But
he kind of turned that around, too, and also talked about the super minority and how, well, Democrats have had the luxury of just, you know, taking shots. So he kind of put the onus back on them. Well, they need to reach out to us.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, of course, he didn't say the Republicans should give in more. but the fact that he's even had, yeah. I mean, you should take that as a sign. And we know, you know, the leadership that I talk with in the House recognizes that they're going to have to try to find solutions that work for more people. I mean, because literally they were writing budgets that they liked that they weren't giving Democrats any clue about what was going on. And so you're going to have some buy-in.
So just as there is an investigation into absentee votes in the 9th Congressional District, there's another one going on in the election that saw Democrat Rachel Hunt defeat incumbent Republican Bill Brawley. But unlike Mark Harris, Rachel Hunt was seated in the legislature in Raleigh. Why the difference?
Well, there's two things. The biggest difference being the fact that Rachel Hunt was certified, her election, the House District 103 race, was certified by both the county board and the state board. You'll recall that the reason Harris hasn't been seated is because the state board refused to certify his election, citing these irregularities. There were no concerns at the time that they certified Rachel Hunt's election, so she's been seated. So, and then practically speaking, when I again spoke to some House leadership this week, they said, look, we don't even think procedurally they had the standing to not seat Rachel Hunt. Mm-hmm. So I would expect to hear calls for some sort of legislative inquiry into these irregularities later this month.
So late last year, we had a shooting, Ann, at Butler High School in which one student shot and killed another. That was followed by the discovery of guns in other schools over the course of several days. And on Monday afternoon of this week, one CMS student shot another CMS student as they got off the school bus or away from the school bus. Again, this happened after school hours, off school grounds, away from the school bus. So it's a different thing than the Butler shooting, but nonetheless, it's more two students involved in gun violence.
And have they charged a student?
I don't know. I was going to ask you because the student who was shot is not cooperating with police.
Right, and there's been some really elaborate tap dancing in terms of school officials and the police saying they have not said, to my knowledge, that the shooter is a student, but they have said that it was someone who got off the school bus. So, okay. You know, the driver drove away, so unless it was a stranger on a bus, and then it does raise the question of, was that gun at school all day? Was that gun on the bus? I suppose it's possible that that gun was hidden somewhere right at the stop, but it just shows that permeability of that membrane between community violence and what people experience on school grounds and on the school bus.
Well, after the Butler shooting, CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox promised to ramp up school security, and on Tuesday night, he laid out a new plan.
I wish that we weren't in this position. Mm-hmm. But we live in a society where guns have become all too prevalent. And quite frankly, it's not anything that I think any of the professional staff in this district ever thought they would find themselves doing. But quite honestly, the shooting at Butler changed the game in this community.
So what precautions are they instituting and when?
Well, they're most of the ones that we've been talking about. They gave a little more of a timetable. The panic alarm cards, they said they've got 8 schools. These are the things. Yeah, that let you signal what's going on, anything from a mass shooting to a fight. 8 schools will be getting those in January, about 8 more in February and March. We've been talking about the video camera monitoring. They're focusing on elementary schools and particularly on playgrounds and the mobile classrooms, which has been a source of anxiety for parents. I think they said 11 schools are done, 15 more by the end of January. They're adding or repairing fencing at 13 schools, which they haven't named. They're doing active survival training. But the biggest thing that's been sort of this point of contention has been gun searches.
Right.
Because, as we'll recall...
Well, they're bringing in dogs for that, aren't they?
They are. And it's been part of this evolution of people saying, you've got to screen all students as they come into school. And Dr. Wilcox and his staff saying, no, that's just not practical. That's not a good thing. And then the Butler shooting happened, so they kind of came out and said, we are going to do this. We're going to hit all the different high schools with these random wanding searches. And they've started doing the math on that, and that's really problematic. He was talking Tuesday night about 2 seconds to walk through it. They're going to bring in now, they're saying, these portable walk-through things like you go through at the airport, and coupled with wands. And they're saying 2 seconds, 6 seconds. I went into the government center this week where they do basically that. You set down your bags and they check your bags and you walk through a door. And if you don't set it off, you wait for your bag. And if you do set it off, they wand you. Mm-hmm. I was the sixth person in line. It took me 4 minutes to get through, which is not a huge amount, except when you start calculating 40 seconds per person. Right. By 3,000 students, and it's just mind-boggling. Even if you have 10 very fast-moving lines, you're talking 3 hours.
When will they decide what? Oh my God! When will they decide what's going to happen here? Because the plan was to have these random wandings and metal detectors and dogs walking through classrooms sniffing for gunpowder and things like that, and students would not be able to opt out. So, when are they going to make a decision on how they're going to do this?
They have said that they are going to do a high school, presumably a full-size high school, not a little magnet school, the last week of January. And mm-hmm. they're going to see how it goes. It's going to have to take at least 30 staff. They're going to do everybody, and then they're going to report back. So I think some school is going to be really bent out of shape when they have to do that. I think then what they'll end up doing is what they called their other two alternatives, where they swoop in on one building on a campus and or they bring the dogs in. And the dogs aren't going to be sniffing students. They feel like that would be intrusive. Right. They're going to take kids out of a classroom, they'll wand the students themselves, and meanwhile the dog goes through the classroom and sniffs the bags, and if he alerts on anything, they react to that.
So meanwhile, Superintendent Wilcox is getting a raise. He was making $288,400. Now he'll get $307,000 a year. I think that's a $37,000 raise, more than 6% increase. His new contract will eliminate his discretionary performance bonus. Why that amount? Why eliminate the bonus? Why now?
They didn't really talk a lot about that. They've been talking behind closed doors, and this is actually way overdue. He's been in the job about 18 months, so they have done his...
He's been in the job for 18 months, and it's way overdue for a 6% raise to $307,000? Really?
You know, I think you could argue that this is maybe a two... Well, he was overdue for his bonus. His original contract was $280,000. He got the automatic 3%, which is what got him to the $288,000. And then they said they would do by November 30th, a performance bonus, and they did not do one. Right. And so I think they kind of decided that's maybe bad optics.
And they're also reimbursing him. Is this right? The school board is reimbursing him for his contributions to the North Carolina Teachers and State Employees Retirement System. This is his retirement plan. Is that right?
Yes.
Why doesn't he have to pay into the plan like everybody else?
You know, it always amazes me that those of us who make less than six figures are expected to save for our retirement. And this is not just a Clayton Wilcox thing. This is executives. This is all the superintendents I've seen, they evidently need additional public support to help pay for their retirement. So, you can argue whether it's too generous or not. Marcus Jones at the city makes $318,000 a year. So,
okay. Let me continue skepticism here, because in the past, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham urged the president to hold firm and demand funding for a border wall, or it would be the end of his presidency. The president has held firm, and the government has been shut down now for 3 weeks. Today's payday. Most of the people on the payroll are not getting any money. On Tuesday night, the president made an Oval Office speech, which most pundits described as much ado about nothing, but not Lindsey Graham.
This is the most presidential I've seen President Trump. It was compelling, and everything he said was true.
Compelling is in the eye of the beholder, of course, but facts are facts, and that last statement, that everything the president said was true, is demonstrably untrue. The speech was fact-checked by any number of experts, and it was full of inaccuracies. Would somebody please explain to me how these things keep being said? There's tape.
There's Fox News.
There's tape. Okay, nobody can answer the question. We're moving on to therapy animals, because I think we all need some some therapy. Therapy animals are everywhere. You see them on airplanes. You see them in schools now, because everybody has to have their therapy animal with them. But there is a new breed making the scene.
They're so funny.
That's right. Therapy pigs. This is the brainchild of CMPD Officer Chad Webster, who adopted two pigs into his family, and he's having them trained to become certified therapy animals, and he got the idea because he thought it would be cool and different, but there is more to it than that.
I would say it's probably a little more than having a puppy, because they are very intelligent. There's a certain amount of criteria they need to meet, a certain number of commands they need to obey.
Mm-hmm. They already know commands like spin, ring the bell, and push the toy car. And he says that they are the most intelligent animals he has ever met. If they're that smart, I wonder if how they if they object to what he's calling them. He's calling them the Bacon Response Team. Oh, my.
There's either a great sense of humor in a police department that's willing to have police department pigs, or, you know, you have to wonder if this was April 1st, but it seems to be a real thing.
What happens when the pigs grow up? Like, they're not going to stay. Are they going to still be therapy pigs?
Well, I don't know. Are they those Vietnamese potbelly pigs, which stay pretty small?
I don't know. Maybe.
We have a friend who got a small potbelly pig that has now grown into a large potbelly pig.
Oh, really?
Stay tuned.
Well, and if you listen closely to that segment, I believe he actually said that one of the pigs that he adopted is mentally handicapped, too. So, or maybe mentally handicapped. So, this is just... It smells like a spoof story, but I've seen the video. There are cute pigs. There's a police officer.
I smell bacon cooking. Yeah. That's what I say. And Dawes Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Joe Bruno, thank you for joining us from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Nick Oxner, same to you from WBTV News. And Steve Harrison, a reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.